Thank you. Well, it's a great pleasure to give this lecture. And I thought that, actually, a little bit contrary to what I see, because people seem to be giving talks on really current topics. Contrary to that, I thought that it would be a good idea to give you a survey of certain things that we have done in the past several years. So I won't be able to concentrate on any of it in great detail, but I hope to be able to show you the big picture. And my idea was that, that's why I put this thing in intrinsic approach in the title, because I thought that when you're working with a direct limit Lie algebra such as GL infinity, you certainly have the opportunity to try doing things in terms of the finite dimensional Lie algebras which form the limit. And of course, historically, that was the first approach, and you can do you can prove many interesting things, many interesting theorems using this approach. But contrary to that, I want to try to convince you that also a completely intrinsic approach will work, and show you some of the things that we have done in the last few years. And I actually have high hopes that one can do some kind of structure theory for GL infinity, which will be at the same level of detail which we know for the finite dimensional simple Lie algebras. Now, that may be a slight overkill, but I do hope that that actually is possible. And so let me show what kind of questions I'm asking. First of all, so for this talk, I will just, my G will just be GL of V, where V is a, the field will be C, and V is just C infinity, the standard representation of V. Now, that's not, that's this C infinity, not this. I want to start the talk with the remark that I know certain parts of this picture also for other direct limit Lie algebras. But I thought that I will concentrate just on this example, well, just because essentially of lack of time. But in general, of course, many of these questions would be open for other types of algebras. And when I say other types of algebras, I don't mean the algebras like O and S. You have O infinity. So you can think of this just as G infinity. Of course, there is O infinity. There is SP infinity. Most of the problems that I'll be talking about are known for those. There are other types of algebras, and there's a whole school of people who study them, such as the diagonal limits and so forth. And in general, I mean that it would be very interesting to see how far one can push really sort of this intrinsic approach, but I don't know that. So I'll just limit myself to this. So my starting point, so I would like to talk, I would like to talk both about the Lie algebra and its representation. So let M be a GL infinity module. Okay. My first remark is that it has a very nice structural invariant, which I will call, so GL infinity is G, so I'll be saying G. So my first invariant is G of M, which is the subalgebra in G, consisting of all vectors G in G, such that G acts locally finitely on M. And that's what we nowadays call Fernando Katz subalgebra of G corresponding to the module M. The role of this algebra, in my opinion, has been underestimated in the classical case, in the case of finite dimensional Lie algebras. It is a non-trivial theorem proved independently by Fernando and Katz about 15 years ago, that all vectors in a finite dimensional Lie algebra, which act locally finitely on a given module, do form a subalgebra. And now, if the Lie algebra is locally finite itself in the sense that it's a direct limit of finite dimensional Lie algebras, this, of course, carries over to that situation. So for GL infinity, we do have this invariant. And one thing is, I would like to show you, roughly speaking, what modules look like when you take into account this invariant. Something, of course, that's an open question is, you'll excuse me that I'll start with open questions, but okay, so it is an open question. To describe all subalgebras G of M corresponding to irreducible G modules M. This question is open even when G is finite dimensional, therefore it's open here too. If we're trying to have some kind of analogy with the finite dimensional case, one class of modules that I believe that are quite widely known in this audience are weight modules. So if I would be looking at weight modules, I would have to tell you what's a Cartan subalgebra and then require that it acts in a certain way on M. But what I want to do is first try to relate the definition of a weight module with this algebra. The result is nicer in the finite dimensional case than it is here, but it's still, so let me show you what I have in mind. So if for a moment, if let's say G prime be finite dimensional simple Lie algebra, or semi-simple. By the way, all I will be talking about doesn't matter more or less. Am I talking about SL infinity or GL infinity? So for the purpose of this talk, I just said GL infinity, but if you prefer SL infinity, that's fine. Anyway, finite dimensional simple. And as I said, if M prime is an irreducible G prime module, then I could just consider the condition that a Cartan subalgebra H prime be a subalgebra of the subalgebra G of M prime. And this is a very natural condition, in other words, that the subalgebra G of M prime be a root subalgebra. And I claim that in this case, this is actually equivalent to the condition of M being a weight module. This is a non-difficult statement, roughly speaking, saying that if I have an irreducible G prime module and I require a Cartan subalgebra to act locally finitely on it, then the action necessarily is semi-simple and is such as we know it on a weight module. In other words, this implies that M prime is the direct sum of M prime nu, where nu is in prime dual, and M prime nu is the usual weight space, M in M prime, such that H of M, H dot M is nu of H M for every H in H prime. Okay? So, thinking along those lines, I will tell you right away that it is not true that if I, in the infinite dimensional case that we're talking about, if I just say that I want H prime to be a subalgebra, now back to what I had, if I want H to be a subalgebra of G of M, then it'll act in this way. But at least this opens the discussion of this problem. And of course, it opens the discussion of what a Cartan, what's the invariant definition of a Cartan subalgebra of GL infinity. So here I would like to describe briefly the work that we did with Kalhelm and Nabe about a year ago. And the reference for that. So this part about the Cartan subalgebras is Nabe, myself, and the reference for that is Canadian Math Bulletin 2003, and I don't know the number or the page numbers. Okay, so I would like to talk a little bit about what's the definition of a Cartan subalgebra. Well, here is the general picture that we found. Well, there's three equivalent definitions of it, and one is that it is a locally nilpotent H coinciding with its normalizer. This means normalizer of H in G, and such that, in addition, so this is of course the usual definition. Now, of course, if I had a finite dimensional case, I don't need to say locally. In this case, I say so. This is just the usual definition, of course. And then we have this slight additional condition, natural though, that H acts locally finitely on itself. On itself. Strangely enough, this is not guaranteed in this situation. And it is an open question. What are the algebras that are just locally nilpotent and coincide with their normalizer if I drop this condition? And I believe this is an interesting but sort of technical question. And I don't think we have any prediction is the answer positive or negative. So that's one very natural condition. Then the second is, no, this means this means a union. Okay, locally nilpotent means a union of nilpotent Lie algebras. When you exhaust, right. The word locally, the way we use it here, is we take, in this field, there is this terminology of a local system. When you exhaust G by finite dimensional algebras, you call this a local system. So locally refers to intersection with finite dimensionals. Okay, the second condition is that H must be the space G0 of H. I will explain what this is. This is the maximal locally nilpotent H submodule of G. In other words, now you look at the action of H, the adjoint action, and certainly there is a maximal submodule on which H acts nilpotently. Certainly does act locally nilpotently on itself, and so it is obvious that H is subalgebra here, but it's not obvious that it coincides. So this is the condition. And then you have to still be careful here. Let's see. When I say that this is ambiguous, because this means does the whole H act locally nilpotent or every element? This means that every element acts. Okay. Maximal submodule on which every element of H acts nilpotently, acts locally nilpotently, because, okay? And then you have to add the condition. So this is this condition, and then again you have this plus H acts locally nilpotently on itself, now locally finitely on itself. Okay? So, roughly speaking, if you drop this condition, which I already said that it's additional, this is known to be an equivalent definition of a Cartan subalgebra in the finite dimensional case without this, and without without locally, because well, then it would act nilpotently because G is finite dimensional module. And then there is a third condition, which actually we take literally without imposing any additional conditions, that H is locally nilpotent, and it actually consists that H is the centralizer of so for every element in H, we take its semisimple part with respect to add. So we take the usual Jordan decomposition. Then the all those semisimple parts form this subalgebra, which is abelian, and then you take the centralizer of it. And if H is this, that's the third condition, and that's another actually equivalent definition of a Cartan subalgebra in the finite dimensional case. And here you don't need any additional conditions. And our theorem says now that all these conditions are equivalent, in addition, and there is an explicit description of all subalgebras that satisfy these conditions, and the explicit description is the following. Now, what's an explicit description of a Cartan? So if I was just in GLV, where V would be finite dimensional, of course I know these abstract conditions. I can drop the word locally. But then I need to know what an explicit description is. And an explicit description is simply take a basis of V and take its dual basis in V dual. And we'll then consider... So an explicit description in the finite dimensional case is simply decompose V as the sum of one-dimensional spaces V alpha. And then V star will get decomposed as a direct sum of V alpha dual. And then just consider the sum of V alpha tensor V dual, sorry. Well, yeah, V alpha dual. But let me... use the notations that I'm going to use in the infinite. Well, no, that's okay. I can rewrite it. So let me write like that, and then I can write like that. Okay. So this is an explicit description, and sorry, sum over alpha. Some, yeah. Thank you. I find it very nice that we have actually been able to extend this result. So the result says, I'll keep this maybe, but let's try to erase this. The result says that all these algebras are obtained in the following way. So you fix a maximal system of one-dimensional spaces, subspaces in V and V dual, and I have to say what I mean now, and V lower star. First of all, in this case, if in a finite dimensional case, GL of V is just this. Now, in this case, in the case that I'm considering, it is this, where under this I mean, well, the finite dual of, see, this space I started with as vector space of infinite dimension. Putting infinity there, I meant countable infinity. Now, if I take its dual space, it's uncountable, but I have the so-called finite dual, which you can obtain by choosing any basis in V and taking just the direct sum of, you know, the one-dimensional spaces that are dual to it. And by this V lower star, I mean exactly this space, so it's a smaller space here. And by the way, in the paper, we also consider the cases where V star, V lower star, is some other space. For instance, it's the Hilbert dual and so forth, but I don't have the time to talk here. That's why I said I will just restrict myself to GL infinity. But if you're interested to see some examples, we have a more general theory when just the algebras of the form still of this form. Okay, so now the new thing is that there is this beautiful notion of a maximal system of one-dimensional subspaces in V and V lower star, by which I mean the following. So you choose here a system of spaces V alpha, so they're one-dimensional, and then you take here the corresponding, well, not you take, so the choices, you have to choose these, and these are one-dimensional spaces here, such that, well, they're orthogonal to these in the sense that V star alpha of V alpha is, of V beta is delta alpha beta C, which means that if you have the same index, this is, you know, this space evaluated on this is non-zero, and if you have different indices, the space evaluated on that is zero. So, and then the only condition is that this system, so the system that I'm talking about, consists of both of these spaces. And if this is maximal, in other words, if you can't add a one-dimensional space here and a one-dimensional space here so that you preserve, you know, you get a system with this property, then that's what it is. So it's a maximal system of one-dimensional subspaces in V and V star, or if you want to think of it, it's a maximal system of dual one-dimensional spaces. And then the answer is that every Cartan subalgebra, now in the finite dimension case, if this space is finite dimensional, it's an easy exercise to see that if the system is maximal, then they form, well, just dual bases, V alpha and V alpha star. And in the infinite case, that's not true. And then such a system has the following obvious invariance. So if I have these spaces, then I can consider their common kernels. So if I consider the common kernels of these spaces, that's a subspace here. And that's what we denote by V, V naught. And then the common kernel of these is a space here, so we denote it by that. And the theorem simply says that a Cartan subalgebra H is the following thing. It is V naught tensor V star naught, direct sum with, well, the obvious direct sum as before, V alpha tensor V sum over alpha. In particular, it's abelian. It is not true, though, that it consists of semi-simple elements in general, because this space is does not consist of semi-simple elements if it's here. It may be that this is not here because it may be that one of these spaces, V naught and V naught star, is zero, and then you just get the usual thing, and that's exactly when a Cartan subalgebra will consist of semi-simple elements. And if both of them are non-zero, it's it does not consist. And you certainly have a class of so-called standard Cartan subalgebras, and that's the case when these spaces when the maximal system consists of dual bases. And of course that's possible, because remember that the way we built this space was we took a basis here and we took we built the space as built by dual spaces. So that's also possible, but the new effect is that it doesn't have to be that way, and you get all these invariants. And other invariants, for instance, are the sum, something that we call V prime is V prime, for instance, is the direct sum of V naught plus all the spaces V alpha. Okay, so that's another invariant. By the way, this is the maximal subspace of V prime on which H, now the Cartan-Sub algebra, acts locally finitely as an infinite dimensional Lie algebra. So if you wish, a theorem is that if the Cartan-Sub algebra acts locally finitely both on V and V star, V lower star, well then it is standard, then it comes from a pair of dual bases. And if it doesn't act locally finitely on some of the spaces, well then it's new. Okay, so this is a very nice explicit result, and the only problem that is still open is to find some interesting representations that are related to the non-standard Cartan subalgebras. And I don't know how to do that yet. I'm having hopes that this will work, but I don't know how to do that yet. Now, we have found already some objects that are interesting and are related to the non-standard Cartan subalgebras, and those are the Borel subalgebras of GL infinity. But this is really work in progress, so I won't speak about it, but still I'll give you a definition. I'll just give you a definition, because seemingly the definition for a Borel subalgebra is much simpler. So Dimitrov and I are currently studying the most trivial definition, which is simply maximal locally solvable subalgebra of GL infinity. And we have, as I say, work in progress, so we have to check things. But we actually have also an explicit description of this. And we have a somewhat explicit description of the Cartan subalgebras that go in those Borel subalgebras and so forth. But that's something I will skip for this talk. Maybe there will be some later opportunity. Now, something, of course, that we know very well is what are the Borel subalgebras containing a standard Cartan subalgebra. And under a standard one, I now mean when these two systems are indeed dual bases. And that's what I will talk about the next section of this talk will be about that. And so now in general, as I say, I would like to know what's a weight module, or what's a module naturally associated also to those non-standard, but I don't know this yet. So then, H, for the moment now, H will be a standard Cartan. So which you can think of, as I say, the most, well, just take a basis in V and it's dual and take this. And then, of course, you can study modules which decompose over this H as the usual thing, M nu over now nu, this dual. And, of course, if that's the case, you also saw the relation with the very first section is that, of course, this implies that H acts locally finitely, every element of H acts locally finitely, and therefore H is in here. We have to be very careful here, because when I have what is not true is that this algebra in the infinite case as a whole acts locally finitely on M. That's not true. It's built, remember, that each element acts locally finitely. And of course, okay. And as I said, in the infinite case, it is not enough to, even assuming that M is irreducible, it is not enough to say that H is in here in order to derive this decomposition. Okay? But Okay, so now let me tell you a very rough survey of some results on weight modules, because, well, I believe that this is, okay, we have some results also that are intrinsic. And the first thing is that if you have a weight module, it has a natural invariant, which I call the shadow decomposition of M. And so what is this invariant? Okay, so you take, if you have M and is a M weight module, then you have its support, which just consists of all weights that show up here with none. So this is all weights here for which M nu is not zero. So that's just a set, a subset in H dual. And then you can do the following thing. You take a root of G. Now I haven't said yet, but of course G has a root decomposition because it is H plus G alpha, where alpha is in delta. And many people in this audience have studied, you know, locally finite root systems and all of this. This is the most standard case, SL. I mean, systems of type A1 embedded in each other. And I will construct now a splitting of the roots into four groups, starting with M. And this is done in the following case, in the following way. So you look at this support of M, which a priori is some set in H dual. These are the weights. And then you take a root alpha. And then what it does, it's natural to picture the root as sort of an arrow, because if I have an element in the support nu here, then this is nu plus alpha, this is nu plus 2 alpha, etc., because the roots interchange weight spaces. So if I take a point here, well, obviously I just have logically just four possibilities, and then I look at this line here in the support. Obviously I have four possibilities that this line is double infinite, is double finite, or is infinite in one direction, finite in another. Nothing else can happen, right? Then the point is that for this particular algebra, and for an irreducible weight module, so let me write that M is irreducible, it is a result of Dimitrov and myself, and this is the next reference that I'm giving, that is in IMRN, number 5, 1999, 223249. It is a result that the finiteness or infiniteness of this line in a given direction does not depend on the choice of nu. In other words, I've split the roots into four groups. So fixing M splits the roots into delta F. These are the roots that support M is finite in the direction of alpha and minus alpha. And then F, then infinite means infinite in both directions. And then delta plus means alpha finite minus alpha infinite, and minus means the opposite. And of course this depends on M. Okay, in the case when G is finite dimensional and the module has finite multiplicities, this goes back to Fernando. But the point is that it has been generalized twice since then. One is if G is finite dimensional, but you allow infinite dimensional weight spaces, is still true. And then for GL infinity is also true. So that's sort of important. So now I'm getting this picture that G, I guess we don't need this very much. Okay, so G split now as a sum of four subspaces, but it's actually much better. These are subalgebras. So how do you make subspaces? Well, when you put together the roots of a given type, well, then you get four subspaces, and then you have to put the Cartan algebra somewhere, and we put it in both of these. So what I do is I will write G as GF plus GI. So by definition, the sum is not direct because H is in both. And I define this just to be the sum of weight of root spaces with the property that they're in F plus H, and that's the same. And then I will add to this the plus part and the minus part, in which I do not put H. Okay. All right. Now, good news is that all four of these are subalgebras. Then, as you can see immediately, these two are reductive subalgebras because the properties belonging to F and I are such that are symmetric with respect to the roots, so therefore these are reductive. And the most important, so what I want to write on the board is that out of this I get a completely canonical parabolic subalgebra, which is this. And that's what I denote by PM. And this is the parabolic subalgebra corresponding to M. And the theorem is that this is indeed a parabolic subalgebra. Now, for that matter, I have to give you a brief survey of what Borel and parabolic subalgebras are for you to appreciate, for this to make sense. So let's freeze here a little bit, and let me just remind you. Of course, I could have done this at the beginning of the talk when I talked about Cartans, but it wouldn't have been well motivated, and now you see that we need it. Let me just say that, well, I don't know what's a good definition for a parabolic if the Cartan is not standard, but of course you tend to want the parabolic to be just some subalgebra containing a Cartan subalgebra. But that's certainly true if the H is standard. So for sure, if H is standard, I can define a parabolic related to that H to be just some subalgebra that, that contains H. The point is that you do have also a quite explicit description of those. And first, let's look at the Borel subalgebras. Now, contains a Borel, you're right. Yes, I have to say what's a Borel, and then I have to say sorry. Yeah. Thank you. So it's unavoidable. Now, the Borel, remember, would be locally solvable, which contains H, right? But I do have a description of this in terms of the roots, because if it contains H, it is a root subalgebra. In other words, it's the sum of the form H plus roots. And it's the usual thing. You simply have to split the roots. So this corresponds to splitting of the roots as delta plus union delta minus, so that, well, two conditions are satisfied. If alpha is here, this implies, well, the other way around, that minus alpha is here, and that both of these form subalgebras. In other words, the first condition is that, the second condition is that simply H plus alpha in G plus delta plus G alpha is a subalgebra. What? Right. Thank you. It was, I believe, back then, but now, of course. Anyway, so these are the usual two conditions that give you a triangular decomposition of the roots. And in this case, you also do that. And obtain a quite interesting answer, which is that these, the Borel subalgebras containing H, are in one-to-one, well, bijective correspondence with orders on N, say. Why? Well, I never wrote the roots here explicitly, but let me do that. There's two ways to write the roots of GIL infinity. One is to allow indices from z, in other words, indices that can be positive or negative, but it's easier, and it is equivalent, to allow only indices. So the roots here could be written as epsilon I minus epsilon j, where both I and j are in n. And then, well, you would have to say, in order to say which root is positive, you would have to say what does it mean that I is less than j, right? So in the usual case, you have to do that. And a theorem, again, because, of course, I mean, you have to take some invariant definitions and then prove this, but it's done in the paper. Theorem is that you can take any order on n, and it'll be fine. Now, you have, of course, so this means, of course, that the number of Borels containing the given H is uncountable because you have too many orders on n, and you have some orders which, again, you would want to call standard, which all they can do is, which have the property that, so if I take n, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., well, I can reorder the elements without such that I preserve the property that this thing is well ordered, or I can order them and lose that property. For instance, a very nice Borel subalgebra is if I just keep the order but send one to infinity. In other words, I go like that and then I have a one here. So these are all Borel subalgebras. So the theorem is that all these orders describe all the Borel subalgebras containing the simplest possible Cartan algebra with which we're working at the moment. And then, on top of it, a parabolic, as I was, so it made sense for you to stay for the talk to correct me, is that, you know, a parabolic is a parabolic, is any subalgebra containing B. Okay? And, of course, this now corresponds to certain partial orders, as you will see. I mean, as you can easily see. Okay, so this is an explicit description of all parabolics. And the claim, my claim is that this here is a parabolic subalgebra. And then, then what do you do? Well, you start studying what this decomposition may be. And essentially, the next theorem is, let me see how much time I got. Okay, 15 minutes. Essentially, the next theorem says that you can obtain all possible decompositions occur. So what do I mean by that? Certainly PM can be an arbitrary parabolic subalgebra for a weight module, but also you have one more condition. Now, something that also happens on top of the fact that PM is a parabolic is that the semisimple parts of F and I do commute. Now, you realize that this is the parabolic. This is certainly its nilpotent radical because this consists, well, locally nilpotent, it's not nilpotent. This consists of roots that have no negatives in the parabolic, right? This is how it was built. So these are the roots that come with their minuses. So this is sort of the reductive part. It has H and all roots that go, you know, alpha and minus alpha together. And this is the roots that do not have their minus. So this is obviously the sort of the locally nilpotent radical. And then the important thing is that if you take the commutator of these, each of them has sort of a semi-simple part, which is the commutator. If you take GIM and GIM, this is the semi-simple part of this. And then this is the semi-simple part of the other one. Okay, the important fact is that these two commute. And so these are the abstract properties of the decomposition, and then we have a theorem in the paper which says that any such decomposition actually comes from a module, which means, that you have a very large variety of modules, of weight modules, which appear. So now let me, oh, and one thing also is I need to relate this with the algebra G of M that I started with, the Fernando Katz algebra. So if I have this, it doesn't, unfortunately, fix the Fernando Katz algebra, but that's also a very interesting problem that I would like to mention. So their relationship is actually, strictly speaking, an open problem and a quite interesting one. But what you can see easily is that, well, actually, it is true that G of M, which is the subalgebra of elements that act locally finitely, contains this. And that's, of course, clear because, well, these were constructed as the roots in the direction of which the support is finite both directions, therefore this must be in here. Then you have the sum with GIM intersected with that, and that's the unknown part. That's very interesting. Certainly contains H, so H is in both of these, because certainly H is in here and it acts locally finitely. And then you have the plus, okay? So this sort of trimmed version of the parabolic, if you want to think of it as a trimmed version of the parabolic, is G of M. And the interesting thing is, what can this be? And I have a conjecture, and that is that this can be an arbitrary roots of algebra. Let me just comment, taking the time in regard. I have to make some choices because I wanted to. Well, all right, doesn't matter really. Okay, first of all, the obvious remark that this conjecture is certainly false. It's not true if G is finite dimensional. So that's something that's very specific to the infinite dimensional situation, because if essentially, I'm asking the following question. If I took a module, so assume I restrict myself to the case where this decomposition is trivial in the sense that G equals GI. Certainly, I'm allowed to do that, and strictly speaking, I mean, Dimitrov and I have proved that this is possible, as I told you, because I told you that all possibilities do realize. So in that case, if I study what the algebra is in the finite dimensional case, it certainly has a very nice restriction. I mean, it's not an arbitrary roots of algebra. But I believe that here it is. In particular, it could be. Now, in the finite dimensional case, it is forbidden that if I have this situation, the subalgebra be a Borel, for instance. But in this case, it's been already proved by a student of Vera Serganova that, yes, it can be a Borel. So this is an interesting conjecture that if somebody's interested, I mean, we can discuss, but I don't have time here to go into great... Yes? Because GM minus is not in here, because by the definition, every root definitely acts not finitely, because remember that GM minus is those roots which... on which the support is infinite in their direction, and you can easily show that this implies that actually the root does not act locally finite, the root space. Therefore, GM minus certainly will not go into GM. Okay, it's like if take a Verma module, well then... right, exactly. Okay, now, what we have done, also in that paper that I quoted in IMRN, we have presented some modules, because now you can look at this invariant, and try to describe a little bit the modules with the given invariant. Now, a most drastic situation, this is certainly a difficult situation, but a situation that sort of looks more promising at the very beginning is, what if we take G to be GF? So what if we take this? And then describe all modules M which have this property. Now, this would mean that all roots are, in terms of the support, you would have this infinite polyhedron that is finite in all directions, but is infinite because simply you've got infinitely many directions. And the question is, what can you say about such modules? And we have this theorem. Well, not quite. Let me not rush things. Okay, I have a theorem, but let me just write it down. Actually, the theorem that we have is a little bit more general than that. Theorem that we have is that if simply, now, okay, if I have this, of course this implies that G of M is G, right? But I can look at this condition first and not at this, okay? So, because this is not equivalent. And the theorem says that if G of M is G, and you certainly want to call following cats these modules integrable, although in this case we're not discussing the group to which they integrate, but okay, so this is just terminology, so I want this. Well, then I have two cases, and those are that either, and those are mutually exclusive, so this implies that either I have this case, or I have this case. Okay? And in addition here, all weight spaces are infinite dimensional. And that's why we sort of declare, and I think this is a reasonable choice, to think of these modules as the analog of finite dimensional modules, because they have the property exactly that I was saying, that they correspond to a polyhedron, that's the support which is finite in each direction, and those are sort of the analog of finite dimensional modules. Now, something nice about this is the remark that this condition does not imply that the module has the highest weight with respect to any Borel. Probably this will be the last thing that I'll be able to explain during, in the lecture. Now think of it. These are analogs of finite dimensional modules. Now, in finite dimensional modules, the support is a Weyl polyhedron, and every extremal point in that is a highest weight with respect to a certain Borel, right? So if you took something like SL3, then it's a hexagon, and then, well, or a triangle, and then each of these is a highest weight with respect to a certain Borel, which is this or that. Now, in the infinite polyhedron, what may happen is that, yes, it has a vertex which sort of conforms to a Borel, or it doesn't, and that's important. So in this class here, you have two subclasses, or even if you wish three, because if it has a vertex which makes it a highest weight module, then you can ask, well, what is the Borel subalgebra? Is it one of those standard Borels which kept N well ordered? In other words, you didn't move any elements to infinity. Or it's one of those more weird Borels in which you did. By the way, those two Borels are not, I didn't mention that, but another way of talking about these two types of Borels is one that admits a basis of simple roots and the other that doesn't. So all of those more exotic Borels, they do not admit a basis of simple roots. So their highest weight theory is a little bit more interesting because you don't have a basis of simple roots. You only have positive roots. Okay. So, dependent on how you do, you can split these here into classes. So, this is a highest weight with respect to a standard Borel, or a non-standard Borel, or a general Borel, to a general Borel. Okay, or non-highest weight at all. Okay. And I'll just show you the picture for a non-highest weight, which some of you, I'm sure, have seen, because I think we've been talking about this for a while. But still, some of you may not have seen it. And the way you do it is, so now you have to, I didn't say anything about See, trying to stay within the intrinsic approach, I didn't say anything of how M is made out of finite dimensional modules or modules over the GNs that make out G. But in the construction, this is sort of unavoidable. So you, in order to construct an M, all you have to do is to put representation of this increasing sequence of Lie algebras that forms G. You have to put each of them in the next so that the thing is a weight module. It has this property that's finite in all directions, and you never put a highest weight into a highest weight. Therefore, if you don't do this at each stage, you will lose the highest weight. Because, of course, if you had a highest weight in the limits, well, then that highest weight would be a highest weight if you restrict your Borel to the GNs, right? So if you ensure every time that you don't put a highest into a highest, there's no way how in the limit you will have a highest, right? And the beautiful picture that Ivan Dimitrov was able to come up with already many years ago is this. You take, so this is my SL2 that forms, or GL2, okay. Now for some reason I'm thinking SL, but it doesn't matter. Okay. All right, let's think SL, it doesn't matter. And here I will take the three-dimensional representation, and here I will take a representation which I'll let you compute its highest weight, but whose support is this. So it's a triangle of length 4, and then here I'll take a tetrahedron of length 5. And it'll have 5, the length will be 5 here, okay. And then what you do is you take this and put it in here as length 3. And then what you take is, what you do is take this triangle and put it in here as length, as this next. So you have 5 guys here. So there is a triangle here, which is of length 4 as here. And no highest weights. So the highest weights of this are these three, of these are these two. So no highest weights going into a highest weight. And therefore, in the limit, you obtain something which has one-dimensional weight spaces, has all the properties, and has no highest weight with respect to any Borel. And that's not surprising. It's simply, the way I think about these things is not that they're pathology. It's simply, you know, this is why it's interesting. And these things are not pathological in any way because Dimitrov was able recently to actually go ahead and classify them. And I had a little more material here, but what I'll do is finish just by saying that Dimitrov has classified all irreducible GL infinity modules with finite dimensional weight spaces. Now, this is another, so we heard finite dimensional weight spaces. This is another extension of the work of Mathieu in a different direction because we heard the superalgebra talk this morning, which classified, in this talk he didn't classify, but Grancharov has classified all SLN1 modules. So for a finite dimensional superalgebra, now this is an infinite dimensional Lie algebra. And Dimitrov has classified all of those. And it's not, it has different flavor from Mathieu because you get sort of the cuspidal modules are easier in my understanding, but there's a lot of non-cuspidal modules which he has to worry about. See, in the case Mathieu worked, he didn't have to classify finite dimensional representations, right? But here you have to classify all representations that come from this sort of constructions and uniformly make them, you know, work together with all of them, and that's been done. And I can't give you a reference, sadly, for this, but soon, I hope, because it's still in progress, but that should be available very soon. Yes? Oh, for standard ones. I had this general thing about the non-standard ones, but then I said that I only know about weight modules for standard ones. For non-standard ones, one has to even think what's the right definition and what are the right representations that are associated to non-standard ones, and I don't know that yet. And I want to give one more piece I want to give one reference before I finish, and that is, actually I planned, if I had time, to mention also some geometric theory related to all of this, but there is no time, because what one can do is look at the corresponding groups that occur, corresponding parabolic subgroups. We work in the algebraic category, but there is a reference for this, and I'll just leave it at that. And the reference is Dimitrov, Penkoff, and Wolf, American Journal of Mathematics, 124, 2002. Thank you very much.